This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and tonight's show will feature some excellent big band and jazz music, and also some very out music by a Philadelphia artist I much respect. And I've got very candid interviews to go along with both of these segments. The Philadelphia artist is Steve Cohen, and his music has given our culture lyrically gay music that can touch you, hit home, and even make you laugh. But before we get to Steve, I'm very pleased to explore some jazz and big band music with an excellent tour guide, Ellen Seeling. Now, I've known about her work for quite some time because she and her partner, Gene Feinberg, performing as a band called Deuce, released two excellent jazz fusion recordings. And her background goes much deeper than that, as you'll soon hear. But she got my attention again with a new CD. It's called Montclair Women's Big Band, Ellen Seeling Director. And the big band classic that opened the show, called Brownsville Express, also opened that recording. I asked Ellen to tell me about the new album.
Well, this is our first recording. The band was formed in 98, and we recorded in 03, and it was released in 05. So we've been together for a while. This recording was produced by four of us, actually. Me, my partner, Gene Feinberg, who is also my assistant director and tenor player, Barbara Price, our business manager, and Leslie Ann Jones, who is the studio manager at Skywalker Sound here in California, Marin County. And it features 14 classics, including five vocals. The singers on the album are Vicki Randall of the Tonight Show Band, Linda Tillery of the Cultural Heritage Choir, and local Bay Area chanteuse Pamela Rose. It's, I like to think the album swings really hard, and it features some excellent Bay Area soloists. We're very proud of it. We've gotten good response so far, and I don't know when the next one will be, but hopefully we can get some mileage out of this one yet.
I'm going to continue this part of the interview with music in the background by Deuce, starting with a track from their 1986 self-titled release. The song is my favorite from that album and is called Texas Pearl. How did you get your start in music?
Oh boy, well, my dad was a trumpet player, although, you know, I never heard him play. He quit playing when he got married. He tried making a living on, well, the Midwest, I guess what they used to call tenor band circuit back in the 50s, right after World War II. And I think he probably once he'd never made enough money to actually buy food and get all of his shirts cleaned on time. So he just sort of gave it up. But he had a great record collection and loved music. And we always had really pretty hip jazz recordings around the house, especially for 1950. My dad had, you know, Count Basie and Duke Ellington and all the big bands. But also we had Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and some stuff like that. And so I think I was just exposed to it at a young age. And then when it came time to play, you know, in school, which was kind of late for me because my little school didn't really have a band until I got to seventh grade, which is quite late, actually. Anyway, I wanted to play the drums, and my folks said, no, we can't handle listening to that down the basement all day long. So then I wanted to play the violin, and there was no string program in the school, so that was the end of that. So trumpet was really my third choice. I just sort of loved the sound.
Who were your musical influences?
I think I started out, like most kids in high school, really liking the big band stuff, especially you know, Maynard Ferguson and Stan Kenton and stuff like that. And then as I got a little bit older in high school, maybe my junior, senior year, somebody gave me Miles Davis's Kind of Blue album, which just really blew my mind. And then after that, I started listening to small band stuff. And then by the time I went to college at Indiana University, which was one of the first schools to have a really serious jazz degree program, the department was a one-man department run by David Baker, who's very well known as, you know, the legendary jazz educator. You know, I got a great education there and really learned what the music was all about. And, you know, I like to think my solo influences are Miles and Freddie Hubbard, and I hope Lee Morgan and Woody Shaw. Those are my favorite trumpet players right now.
You've played on the recordings of many, many artists. For the information of my listeners, could you mention a few of those?
Oh, okay, off the top of my head. Well, let's see. I went to New York initially to play with one of the first all-women's rock bands signed to a large indie label, and that was the band Isis in 1974. And from there, I picked up Laura Nyro's sort of comeback gig in 75, which produced an album called Season of Light. And it was a band album, and Gene and I were the horn section for that. And we toured with Laura for about a year and did a live album, and it was wonderful. And then right after that, we both got snagged to be the horn section for Chic. And we did an album with them called Say Chic, which included their biggest hit, I think, called The Freak. And they also produced a recording for the group called Sister Sledge right after that, which that group had a huge hit called Dear Family. And Gene and I are the horn section on that album. After that, I did a whole bunch of salsa recordings, but probably the one that people might recognize is the one called Larry Harlow Presents Latin Fever, which was one of the first recorded, or I think the first recorded women's salsa band in the United States on Fania Records. And then after that, I did a string of women's music recordings. I've recorded with Margie Adam, with Holly Near. And then Gene and I sort of got the bug to put our own thing together. So I think in 1980, we put our fusion band together called Deuce, and we've released two recordings to date of that group, which was original fusion, for lack of a better word. It wasn't, it wasn't heavily rock and roll as much as it was more like instrumental pop. And our last recording was in 96. And we that's been on hold for a while. We were a little disappointed with the lack of reaction we got not from the press, but really from radio stations, which I don't think radio stations have been playing much fusion for the last 15 years or so. So that was kind of disappointing. And at that time, we decided to put together the big band. So Barbara Price, who produced the Michigan Women's Music Festival for years and now owns the Montclair Women's Club in Oakland, and I put our heads together, and Gene, of course, was involved as my assistant director. We put together the big band in 98, and it's, you know, a big band is so much work. It's pretty much been all I've been able to do in terms of band for the last almost 10 years. Although I'm on the faculty of the Jazz School, which has been up and running now for about 10 years, and is based in Berkeley, and I'm very involved with the Jazz School also. So those two things keep me really busy.
That's like real stream of consciousness. You covered almost my questions.
Oh, sorry.
But I have to go back and ask what it was like performing with and playing with Isis.
That was one of the high points of my life. I don't know how else to say it. I left college. Actually, they sort of hired me sight unseen on Howard Johnson's recommendation. Howard Johnson is a fairly well-known instrumentalist in New York City. He's still around. He's Nedra Johnson's father, I believe.
Yes.
Anyway, Howard and Carol McDonald, who was the lead singer, were sort of used to hang together, and Isis was looking for a trumpet player. So Carol hired me sight unseen and flew me down to New Orleans to join the band to do a recording, and that's how I met everybody. And I guess it was the second Isis recording for Buddha Records, produced by Alan Toussaint in New Orleans. So, I mean, I was still in college, you know, so this was, like, very heady stuff for me. And it was a wild bunch of women, let me tell you. It was 1975, I think. But I loved it. It was a wild time. It was a wonderful time. I had a lot of fun. I still have a lot of friends from that band. And it made a huge difference in my playing because it just totally took me out of the whole academia thing and opened up possibilities of playing other kinds of music and playing the horn in a different way. If I hadn't done that gig, I don't think I would play like I play today.
I want to share with you just a bit of the band Isis, which featured both Ellen Seeling and Gene Feinberg. From the 1975 album, Ain't No Backin' Up Now, here's Bobby and Maria.
Because together they'll make it.
And following Isis, here's some more Deuce with a song called The Whole Enchilada from their 1996 album, Windjammer. About the band Deuce. The focus of the band was women, but it was a mixed band, and I read that that was deliberate.
Well, yes, it was deliberate because when you limit your personnel, and really in any way, that's exactly what you do. You limit your personnel. You know what I mean? So we wanted to have it be representative of the women players who were out there who we felt were really, really good players. But we didn't want to, for example, have a band where there were only maybe one or two drummers in town that could do the gig, and if they couldn't make it, we'd have to use another woman who wasn't up to the level of the rest of the players in the band. And it was pretty much as simple as that. There's a lot more depth now in terms of rhythm section players. In terms of women rhythm section players, I mean, we're talking 30 years ago, 25 years ago. And I think in New York at the time, there was one or maybe two drummers that we even thought, women drummers that we thought could play the music the way we wanted to hear it played. Maybe, I don't think there were any bass players or guitar players back then. So, sort of by design, you know, we wanted to have a strong women's presence in the band, and not just Gene and I, but because it was a 7-piece band for a while. We wanted mostly for the music to sound good, and since it was all original music, we were real, protective of its performance.
I have a Hot Wire magazine article about U2 from 1985, and Gene was quoted as saying, "Besides wanting to have the best musicians backing you up, that a second reason for having a mixed band was that if you have an all-female band, the emphasis is on that and not on the music." Has your thinking changed about that?
I would say my thinking has matured around that. And I should also say that even way back then, when we did women's music festivals, which we did frequently, we would put together a women's band. And we did that for many years so that we could play at Michigan and other places. And we loved that too, you know. But for our regular band at a regular venue, it was always mixed. And I think when we put the big band together, my thinking, which was, I don't know, almost 10 years ago now, and definitely about 15 or 20 years after that article, I started to think like, I got really tired of looking at the festivals here in California. We had moved from New York to California in 1989. And I'm looking at, you know, the San Francisco Jazz Festival and, you know, all the big local festivals, all the big clubs, and seeing all the jazz trades come out all the time, the magazines. No pictures of women, no recordings by women, no headliners, you know, no groups led by women instrumentalists. The singers, okay. And I just got so tired of it. I felt like, you know, that quote from Network, "We're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore." And I just figured that the way to really get people's attention, at least out here, was to put together a slamming women's big band and just try to work it and try to record it and be in everybody's face as much as possible. So that's what I've been trying to do with the big band. I think that with Deuce, you know, people weren't paying a whole lot of attention no matter what gender we were. I think part of the problem was the fusion thing. And I also think that for jazz purists, they really sort of resent the rock and roll influence. They don't like it. It's very threatening. And in addition to that, I think having a fusion band led by two women horn players is very, I don't want to say unladylike, but you know how fusion is sort of like biker jazz, you know, it's sort of like tattoo kind of jazz, not really legit. And we couldn't get any jazzers to pay any attention to us at all. I mean, we didn't really belong anywhere.
Deuce had two albums which were 10 years apart. How were they different?
The first recording, how do I want to say this? The first recording included some vocals on the advice of a number of record companies, actually. And we learned after spending a lot of time and money doing that, that record companies will tell you one thing and then do something else. And that's exactly what happened with us. And I still have, you know, letters from Clive Davis and people like that saying, well, we really love it, but we don't really know how we would market it. So on the second recording, which was considerably later, we also aimed for airplay, but by that time there was the smooth jazz movement and the Quiet Storm whole thing and broadcast architecture and all of that, and we were trying to fit in their format, and it was sort of our last shot to get airplay and to get signed by a label that was going to support us so that we could tour with, you know, a band, which is really difficult to do financially. So we did an album that we thought was going to get that kind of airplay, and still didn't get it. You know, we found out sort of after the fact that broadcast architecture is not interested in any sort of music that has brass leads or tenor leads. They're looking for guitar and soprano saxophone. But also, you know, when one person is picking the programming for hundreds and hundreds of stations, really, you're sort of at their mercy.
Which was the best received song from that second recording?
Actually, some of the things down at the end of the CD, which was another problem, we set it up so that the more jazzy, the what we thought was a more esoteric things were sort of at the front, even though I guess we were thinking that we wanted airplay at the time. I don't know why we did that, really, thinking back about it. But the feedback we got later on was that people liked the stuff towards the end, like they really liked Apple Pay. And they really liked Deuces Wild, and they liked, yeah, that's what they liked. They liked those two tunes. They liked Azul. They liked stuff like that. And they liked the opening track, Mahalo Kauai, which is just a bomb.
I quite like the opening track as well. Here's a bit of Mahalo Kauai. From Deuce, we go to the Montclair Women's Big Band and River's Invitation. And the name Montclair Women's Big Band came from?
We're based at the Montclair Women's Club in Oakland. Montclair is a part of Oakland, and it's a small village. And Barbara Price, who is my business partner, owns the Montclair Women's Club. We wanted a band that would have a name that people could recognize. They would know right away that it was a big band, a classic jazz big band of women. So it just sort of came together.
Of course, the focus of my programming is on GLBT music, so I have to ask, are all the band members lesbian?
No, but we have a very healthy representation.
When the big band performs, what song gets the biggest audience reaction?
Well, we have a lot of things that get a really great audience reaction, but off the top of my head, I would say the track on the album called River's Invitation, really a crowd pleaser. Because it's kind of funky, and also because the band really kicks ass on that. So people love it, you know, it's hard to, you know, and it's a blues, it's sort of disguised, but, you know, like my friend Frank Martin says, you can't lose with the blues, and boy, is that true.
Do the classics do very well? Caravan, String of Pearls? I would think they would.
They do. One of the things I try to do with the album is to have classics, including big band classics. Like, other tunes are not necessarily known as big band tunes. The two you mentioned are definitely big band classics. But that arrangement of Caravan in particular, I completely reworked. So we opened it up for solos. We played it much faster than the arrangement is intended to be played. We changed up the bass line, and we added some drums. So even though they're classics, they've been kind of reworked, not totally rearranged, but we've done them in our own style. We've definitely put our imprint on them.
Is there an overall message you hope your music gets across?
Message. Well, I just hope that when people listen to it, they hear a band, that they don't hear a collection of players, but they hear a band that's been together, that enjoys playing together, that has a real sense of camaraderie, and that the music mostly hits a groove and that the soloists have something to say.
Hi, this is Steve Cohen, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's Queer Radio with Attitude.